It's the story of a record label that defined hip-hop and impacted the music industry forever. In the 25 years since it began, Def Jam Recordings has built up an unbelievable roster of recording artists, influencing all areas of culture, fashion, lifestyle, film, art. It's become the sound of young America, akin to Motown in the 60s. The first single released by Def Jam Recordings was Tila Rock and Jazzy J's It's Yours. We're looking back on 25 years of Def Jam with the co-founder, Russell Simmons. And Russell, I want you to take me back to 1984 and to kind of help you set the scene of the very beginnings of Def Jam. I want to read off for you the titles of some other songs that were top singles in pop music that year. There was Owner of a Lonely Heart from Yes, Karma Chameleon from Culture Club, Let's Hear It for the Boy from Denise Williams, and Against All Odds by Phil Collins. So into that environment, you and Rick Rubin started something that really had not been heard of before. So take me back there and explain why you thought this could succeed and why you felt like it was needed.
Well, in 1984, I was entrenched in Run DMC and in Jimmy Spice and my Action Orange crush, and I managed Houdini and Fearless Four, and there were a lot. It was an underground scene, and it was a scene that was developing to kind of give voice to a voiceless generation, people who felt they were locked out of what was going on in the mainstream. And so that's what we were doing in Harlem and in the Bronx and in Queens. So I was entrenched in hip-hop. I had a total disdain for all that that you mentioned, and I had my own cultural kind of little box I lived in.
I want to play for you one of the very first two singles that Def Jam released. One of them was LL Cool J, I Can't Live Without My Radio, and the other one was this one. You know, some from the very beginning, for you at least, urban music was a multicultural thing.
It was multiracial. It was singularly cultural.
Right.
It was hip-hop. So it was multiracial but singularly cultural.
I want to take you back, though, to your business decisions. Because, I mean, as far as I know, when Rapper's Delight went to the top of the charts, the business executives at the major labels thought that was a one-off. They thought that was a kind of a novelty song to a certain extent. Did you think that you could turn rap into a successful business, or did you just feel like it was almost a public service to get it out there?
I guess you could say that. I would never have been so say, oh, it's a public service, but I felt it was a business, but small business maybe. But the excitement of getting it out there was what drove me.
And you ended up actually signing a lot of unknowns to your record label. Some of them, like, you know, were not unknowns later on. You signed Warren G, and we have a little piece of Warren G here with Nate Dogg.
It was a clear black night, a clear white moon. Warren G was on the streets trying to consume some skirts for the E so I could get some phones rolling in my ride, chilling all alone. Just hit the
east side. That was Leo Cohen. Saw him on a record. I forget the name of the artist. It was an artist. And Warren was on the record with that artist. And Leo played me the video and said, not him, the guy next to him.
Huh.
And Leo brought in Warren G.
Well, how did you sift the wheat from the chaff there? How did you figure out who was the true talents there?
Oh, I was lucky. I had a lot of talented people around me. You know, in the case of LL Cool J, he sent the record in and Rick found it. And in the case of the Beastie Boys, Rick was a part of the band. It was Rick that was defined. So he made that record, It's Yours. I remember commentating, illustrating, description, giving adjective, expert, analyzing someone. And the track that he put under him was brilliant.
You still remember the lyrics? Let's hear a little bit of LL Cool J's first single for Def Jam. This is I Can't Live Without My Radio. So we're speaking with Russell Simmons, founder of Def Jam, and among many other titles that you have. I want to talk about LL Cool J because he is now ubiquitous. I mean, LL Cool J at the time was a young kid, but now LL Cool J is just part of our celebrity pantheon. I mean, everyone knows that name. He's an actor in major motion pictures. But, you know, that in and itself represents how far Def Jam and you have come, and how your success with Def Jam in some ways did exactly what you hoped, or maybe unexpected, that you helped to make hip-hop part of the general culture, not just part of the culture for kids from Queens.
Well, it was, I worked for a lot of talented people. It was an experience that was, you know, the whole thing was, you know, a new surprise every day. But, you know, it was the work itself that made me happy. I never really got anything. Like, I never even took time to notice, oh, now look where we are, now look where we are. There were very few moments that you said, oh, look, here's a check, I'm successful. I don't remember those moments. But the moments when, you know, when somebody walked in and played a DMX or first Jay-Z record or any of those records, that's when you feel like you're part of something exciting.
Or Public Enemy or Curtis Blow. I mean, these people
I
who actually
Public
changed
Enemy
the conversation.
Public Enemy sticks in my brain as the act that most gave me the most enjoyment to being part of.
I wonder, having watched the footage of you out there on in Zuccotti Park, and I follow your Twitter feed, and I saw your tweets about offering to pay to clean the park so that they didn't have to remove the protesters. I wonder if you see similarities between the spirit of the kids that you grew up with who wanted to express what they felt they were not getting a chance to express, who felt like they were outside the public discourse, and what you're hearing in Zuccotti Park in New York from Occupy Wall Street.
It's the same, that teen spirit, that young spirit, the collegiate spirit. You know, they're in a stage right now where they're fighting, you know, if they're in college or they just come out of college, you know, they're putting a dampen on that spirit, and they're trying to keep it alive.
You know, when Kanye West showed up at Zuccotti Park in front of the protesters, he took a lot of flack because he was wearing a big gold chain.
So?
And yet, what I want to ask you this. You yourself are part of the 1% that they say they're protesting. And yet,
yeah, but I'm part of the 100%. They're suffering, I'm suffering. Those kids need something that I'm supposed to provide it for them. I'm part of the 100%. Isolation is sickness. Those 1% and who think they are part of it, you know, God bless them. I'm part of the people who need health care. I'm one of the people who needs education. So that's me. That's a different subject, but that's a fact.
Well, let me ask you something. Since we're talking about the anniversary of Def Jam Records, think back over the catalog. I mean, the enormous catalog of Def Jam. What would you offer as a theme or a motto, music, for the protesters?
Oh, God. Public Enemy said, I rope a dope evil with righteous bobbing and weaving and let the good get even.
Russell Simmons, founder, chairman of GlobalGrind.com, co-founder of Def Jam Records. Happy anniversary to you, sir.
Thank you.
And thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Twenty-five years of Def Jam Records. What musical doors did they open for you? Tell us about your favorite Def Jam artist and how the labels influenced you. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Russell told us his views on Occupy Wall Street. He's a part of the 100%. Do you believe that? Of course, it makes more business sense to be a part of the 99% than the 1% brand identity there. What about you?
This is Seth from Hoboken. And enough with the percents. All I know is that I'm somebody who does not feel represented by any politicians.
Play the blame game with us. Do you blame the people on Wall Street? Who do you blame?
This is Mark in Denver. Wall Street does attract smart people, but it attracts smart, hardworking people because the gains are so potentially high, not necessarily because the work itself is that challenging.
Our theme this morning is this relationship between government and corporations. What do you think about it? You know how to go to our Facebook page or thetakeaway.org or call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. John in Warren, Michigan posted this to our Facebook page. If people have a problem with the politics being pushed by corporations, then why do they keep buying their products? If you really want them to stop, you need to use the same capitalist tools they want to use. If you hit them in the pocketbook, they will change. Your views, your calls for boycotts, your pitchforks at 877-8-MY-TAKE or just post to the facebook.com/thetakeaway site. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway.
The There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? And maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.